Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, this evening we begin the study of a new sutta. This is sutta number 22 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Alagadupama Sutta. That is the simile of the snake. It's the simile of a poisonous type of water snake. And this is a very powerful sutta which has a number of quite memorable similes, some of the most famous, well-known similes in the Buddha's discourses. Okay, the sutta begins when the Buddha was living in the Anathapindika's monastery at Savatthi. And at that time, there arose in a monk named Arita what is called a pernicious view. The Pali for this, it's not simply a micchaditti, not simply a wrong view. But this is called papakang ditti gattang, which means a bad or an evil speculative view. And what is this view that arose in this monk, the view that he grabbed hold of? This is the view. And if you don't get it the first time, as you read the sutta, you'll find that this view is stated at least 6 or 7 times. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. Okay, now if you just pay attention to the words of this view, you can see immediately that one who holds this view and one who expounds this view is adopting a view that's actually internally contradictory, self-contradictory, since there are certain things that the Buddha has said to be obstructions, and here this person is saying that these things that the Buddha says to be obstructions are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. So the person is actually contradicting the Buddha. And now, if one knows the discourses or knows something about the Buddha's teachings, one will know that there is a category of qualities ascribed to the Buddha which are part of the essential characteristics of a person who is characterized as a Sammasambuddha, a perfectly enlightened one. Two sets of such qualities are the 10 powers of knowledge, the 10 Tathagata Balas. And then the second one are called the 4, in Pali it's the 4 Vesarajas, may be translated the four grounds of self-confidence. Here, in this book, translated the four kinds of intrepidity. It's a very big word, difficult word, but it means four kinds of claims that the Buddha can make about which he has no fear that anyone can contradict him. So when he makes these claims, he is perfectly confident that he can never be contradicted about these claims. You will find these claims in the Mahasihanada Sutta. This is Sutta number 12 in the Majjhima Nikaya on page 167. They follow immediately upon the Buddha's enumeration of the 10 powers of knowledge. So what are these four kinds of intrepidity, four bases of self-confidence? First, he sees no ground on which anyone in the world, whether an ascetic, Brahmin, Deva, Mara, or Brahma, or anyone else, could accuse him thus, that while you claim full enlightenment, you are not fully enlightened about certain things. The second, while you claim to have destroyed the taints, that is, the defilements, there are certain taints or defilements that you have not destroyed. Okay, the third is the one we want. We'll just skip that and come back to it. Then the fourth one, when you teach the Dhamma to someone, it does not lead him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering, so that there's nobody who can justifiably make such a claim. Then the third one, paragraph 25, this is the one that we want. I see no ground on which any recluse or Brahmin, Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone at all could accuse me thus. Those things called obstructions by you are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. In other words, what the Buddha is saying is that when he designates certain practices, certain mental states to be obstructions, they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. They are truly obstructions to the attainment of liberation. And so now this monk, coming back to our sutta, this monk Arita had come up with this idea that those things called obstructions by the Buddha are not really obstructions for one who engages in them. Now it seems from the text, as we go on, we'll see that Arita was not simply making this one statement, but his view was actually a fuller one, which is not explicitly stated here in the text. We just have, we might call this an innuendo as to the actual view that was being held by Arita. But the following text will bring out the full implications of Arita's view. Okay, now word starts spreading about, because Arita, apparently, he didn't just keep this view within himself, but he started talking about it telling other monks, this is my opinion. And so word starts spreading about, this is what Arita is saying, this is what Arita is saying. And so then the monks start talking to each other, what are we going to do with this monk Arita? And so they decide that they're going to have to talk to him about it to try to dissuade him from this view. And I should mention that this opening passage of the sutta occurs also within the Vinaya Pitaka, that is the book of monastic discipline, in two places. First, it occurs in the background story to one of the rules about holding a wrong view. That's one of the Paccitya rules. And then it also occurs as the background story to the monastic regulation about the suspension or the suspension of a monk from the Sangha, from the monastic order, on the grounds of holding a wrong view. Okay, so now the monks are talking, and so they decide that they have to talk to Arita about this. So when they call Arita, they don't begin by criticizing him at once, but first they ask him, is it true that such a pernicious view has arisen in you? They have to get him to consent to it. And so when they ask him, is this your view? Then he says, exactly so, friend. And then he repeats his view. Okay, then the monks desire to detach him from that view. So then they press him, they question him, they cross-examine him, and then they reprove him, and they say, do not say so, friend Arita. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus, for in many ways the Blessed One has stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. And now what follows brings to the surface the wrong view that Arita had probably adopted. The Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. And then the monks go on to cite certain similes that had been used by the Buddha to illustrate the misery, the suffering, and sensual pleasures. These similes we had already gone through, could it be a year ago, year and a half ago, in Sutta number 54 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Potaliya Sutta. Sutta number 54, beginning with paragraph 15. This is from page 469 on. We don't have to go through the actual passages themselves, but you can just look at them at your leisure. I think the similes are graphic enough on their own without having to go through the full illustration. So the simile of the skeleton, basically this is a chain of bones is thrown to a dog outside a butcher shop, and the dog tries to get some satisfaction by gnawing at the chain of bones, but can't really find much meat on them. Then the piece of meat, this is like a piece of meat picked up by a bird, like a crow or a hawk, and it goes flying off, and the other hawks go flying after that bird, clawing at it, threatening it. A simile of the grass torch, when you hold it in the wind, it blows against you and burns the face and the hair. A simile of the pit of coals, a simile of the dream, you have so much enjoyment, wealth, pleasure in the dream, but when the dream ends, all of that is finished. The simile of borrowed goods that you use, but your use of them, it's only temporary. The simile of the fruits on a tree. One climbs up the tree to get the fruits, and then somebody, a man comes along and chops the tree down, and then one crashes to one's death, or one is seriously injured. The simile of the butcher's knife and block, the simile of the sword stake, the simile of the snake's head. With all of these similes, the Blessed One, the Buddha, has shown how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and so on. And even though the Bhikkhu Arita was pressed, questioned, cross-questioned in this way, still he obstinately adhered to his pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Okay, now a little explanation is necessary. First, in what way are sensual pleasures obstructions? Now, for the monastic order, the Buddha has laid down very firm rules for monks and nuns, which make it an offense of the most serious kind to engage in the sexual act. So any monk or nun who engages in the sexual act is immediately expelled from the order, loses their status as a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. And the Buddha has laid down this rule because his teaching, the Brahmacharya, aims at complete purification and liberation, at freedom from all bonds and fetters. And so to follow that path to its ultimate goal, to its culmination, one has to leave behind, one has to break the bond of sensual desire, sensual craving. To break the bond of sensual craving, as a monk or nun, one enters the training which aims at gradually eliminating sensual craving. And so one makes a firm commitment in one's behavior, bodily behavior, even one's speech, to abstain from any type of action which is conducive to the arising of sensual desire. One aims at complete purity in bodily action, speech, and thought. Even though, of course, in thought it's not always possible to avoid sensual thoughts, but one aims at training the mind to overcome sensual desire. And in the course of progress along the path, according to the early system of progress, there are these four stages of liberation. The first stage we know is the stage of Sotapanna, the stream enterer, who eliminates certain fetters, the fetter of identity view, the view of self, doubt about the Buddha and his teaching, and clinging to rules and observances with the idea that they are sufficient for liberation. The person who reaches the next stage is the stage of the once returner. The once returner doesn't eliminate any fetters, but weakens greed, hatred, and delusion. At the third stage, the stage of non-returner, one completely eliminates the fetter of sensual desire and ill will. And so, therefore, a person can be a stream enterer and a once returner without having overcome sensual desire. It's only at the third stage that one eliminates sensual desire, sensual craving completely. Now, the Buddha did not have only monastic disciples. He also had lay disciples, many lay disciples, laymen and laywomen, upasakas, upasika. And many of these lay disciples attained some of these stages of realization, stages of liberation. Many of them became stream enterers, sotapannas. Many became once returners. They continued to live the home life, the household life. They did not necessarily observe a rule of celibacy. The Buddha describes them as lay disciples living at home, enjoying sensual pleasures, including sexual relations, having families, having children. But still, they have eliminated the fetter of view of self, the fetter of doubt about the Buddha and his teaching, the fetter of clinging to rules and observances. Some who have become once returner have weakened greed, hatred, and delusion even further than the once returner, than the stream enterer. But because they have reached at least the first stage of liberation, they are bound to go on in at most 7 lives until they reach final liberation. Amongst the Buddha's lay disciples were also non-returners. Non-returners, as lay disciples, continued to live at home, the lay life, but they necessarily observed celibacy, because they had broken the fetter of sensual desire. And I would think that those disciples who were once returners and didn't remain content with being once returners, but wanted to go on to attain non-returning within that same lifetime, would also of necessity observe the principle, the precept of celibacy, brahmacharya. Okay, now the fact that lay people could still continue to have sexual relations, but while it can continue to have sexual relations while being stream enterers and once returners, doesn't mean that central desire is not an obstruction to liberation. It just means that for these disciples, they have not yet reached the degree of progress that they are ready to give up sensual desire in order to pursue that quest for liberation full time, to make it a wholehearted endeavor. But they have already developed the right view, the wisdom that can cut through all the fetters. They already have unshakable faith and confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And using that wisdom and that faith, over time, they will be able to give up all the remaining fetters, barriers, obstacles, and achieve complete liberation of mind. Okay, now what seems to have been the case, this might be the background for Arita's view. Arita might have heard that so-and-so lay disciples are stream enterers, so-and-so lay disciples are once returners. And he's seeing that these stream enterers and once returners are living as householders, they're having families, bringing up children. And he's thinking, well, if that is the case, then it must be that sexual relations are not an obstacle to spiritual development, to realization. And so the Buddha has laid down this first parajika rule, this first rule of expulsion from the order for having sexual relations. But there are lay disciples who are having children. Just the other day, so-and-so family, they had a newborn son. This family had a newborn daughter. And they're said to be stream enterers. They're said to be once returners. And so maybe these things are not obstacles at all, and not even obstacles for us who are monks. So why should we have to observe this precept? Why shouldn't we be able to enjoy sensual pleasures too? And so he went around telling the other monks, this is my conclusion. And so when word went around to the other monks, then they questioned him till they established what was his view, and then they refuted him with these similes spoken by the Buddha. Okay, but after they tried to refute him, they didn't succeed. And so since they weren't able to detach him from that view, now in paragraph 4, they go to the Buddha, they pay homage to him, and they tell him everything that had happened. Okay, so now the Buddha sends a monk and asks him to call this Bhikkhu Arita and to bring him to his own presence. Okay, so the monk Arita comes to the Buddha, pays homage, and sits down. Now the Buddha doesn't begin at once by criticizing him, because the Buddha first has to ascertain that the report he's heard is true. So he says, is it true that the following pernicious view has arisen in you? Again, the view is repeated. And then Arita says, exactly so, Venerable Sir. You can see he's not hesitant at all about propounding his view, even in the presence of the Buddha. He doesn't try to waffle or to evade the truth. But he says, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. Okay, now the Buddha becomes very stern. This is a different picture of the Buddha than the usual pleasant, soft, gentle, compassionate figure that we usually see. Here the Buddha really criticizes this monk and says, misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in this way? That is this one thing that the Buddha is very, very strict about, and that is to prevent any misrepresentation of the teaching. And sometimes it might seem that the Buddha is being too stern here, but we have to remember that the Buddha is concerned to protect the Dhamma and prevent it from being distorted and misrepresented. Because if it is distorted and misrepresented and then gets propagated in this distorted form, both to his contemporaries and to later generations, then it will bring much harm. People will have a wrong idea of what the teaching is about. They'll think that one can just freely engage in sensual pleasures and then reap the highest fruits of the teaching. And so the Buddha says, first the Buddha repeats all of the similes that the monks had used. And then he says, no, I'm at the top of page 226. Now I would reformulate the translation a little bit. But you, misguided man, by your wrong grasp, that should come first, because that is the cause for everything that follows. By your wrong grasp, have misrepresented us, that is myself, the Buddha, and injured yourself. You have harmed yourself because you're doing something that's demeritorious and you're blocking your own progress. And you have stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Okay, then the Buddha addresses the monks and he asks whether this monk Arita has kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline. Usmi katto pi imasmin Dhamma vinaye. Usma means a little warmth, even a little bit of heat. Here it's translated rather freely as a spark of wisdom. We could say, maybe more exactly whether he's gotten even a little bit of warmth. You know, when you say somebody is warm, it means he's on the mark. Or somebody is cool, he's off the mark. When somebody is getting close, you say you're getting warm, you're getting warm. That seems to be the idea, whether he's gotten even a little bit of warmth in regard to this teaching. And so the monks say that this is not the case. And then when Arita has been rebuked in this way, then he sits there silently, his shoulders are drooping, his head is down, he's glum, unable to say anything, he's left speechless. So it's very seldom that the Buddha will rebuke somebody so harshly, but when it's necessary to do so, then he will. Then the Buddha questions the monks to show that they don't understand the Dhamma in the way that Arita does, but they recognize that those things that are called obstructions by the Buddha are truly able to obstruct those who engage in them. Then the Buddha comes to a very important sentence. This is at the top of page 227. And this is, you might say, the key, what I would call the key sentence to understand Arita's wrong view. He says that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without perceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire, that is impossible. Taking from the Pali, let me just take it very literally. Anyatreva kamehi, anyatra kama sanyaya, anyatra kama vitakehi kame pati sevi satiti netang tanang vijati. Yeah, the verb here, that one can engage in sensual pleasures. That verb engage is the same as the verb used in Arita's view. He says that one, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One, are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. It's the same verb, patisevati. So that implies that what Arita is really saying is that one can engage in sensual pleasures. One can enjoy sensual pleasures without being defiled by sensual desires, without giving rise to perceptions of sensual desire, without sensual perceptions, or without thoughts of sensual desire. That seems to have been Arita's view, his wrong view. And the Buddha is here saying that this is impossible. Okay, and now we come to the passage that gives the sutta its title. Now we come to the simile of the snake. Here the Buddha is going to take off from the specific case of Arita to a more general application. He speaks of he uses that phrase again, moga purisa, translated translated as misguided men. It's a rather polite translation. Literally, it's something like empty men, vain or foolish men. Learn the Dhamma. Then here comes a list of an early way of classifying the different teachings of the Buddha. The suttas, that are the discourses, Gaya, which are considered texts which have a mixture of verse and prose, Vyakarana, expositions or answers to questions, Gatha, these are texts wholly in verse, completely in verse, Udana, these are exclamations or inspired utterances, Ittivutaka, you could call these sayings, Jatakas, birth stories, stories of the Buddha's past births, Abhuta Dhamma, marvels, stories about marvelous qualities, marvelous events, and Vedala. These seem to be questions and sort of texts that take the form of questions and answers, catechisms. Okay, so some misguided men learn the Dhamma, but having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. That is, they don't use wisdom to look into the meaning, to determine what is actually intended by the teachings. Usually they just grasp upon the words of the teaching and then try to inject their own preconceptions into the words of the text, and then to twist the meaning of the text to make them conform to their preconceptions. And since they don't examine the meaning of the text with wisdom, they don't gain what is here called a reflective acceptance of the teachings. Maybe translated more literally, we should say, these teachings do not It's difficult to put this into English. Since they don't examine the meaning of these teachings with wisdom, the teachings don't become clear to their contemplation, to their reflection. Instead, these persons learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others, and for the sake of winning in debates, or more literally, for freeing themselves in debates. That is, when they get into debates, then for escaping from difficult corners in debates. So they learn the teachings for criticizing others, for cornering others in debates, and for escaping when they get cornered in debates. And they do not experience the good, that is, the goal for the sake of which they have learned the Dhamma. Okay, now these teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of these teachings. That is the key expression here, is this wrong grasp of these teachings. Dukkahitata bhikkhave dhammanam. Grasping the teachings in a wrong way. And now comes the simile. It's said that certain types of water snakes have a poison. They have a poison in their sacs, which can be extracted and used to make medicine, very potent medicine that could cure many types of illnesses. And so people who are skilled in catching snakes make it almost their profession to go about searching for these snakes, catching them, and then they use special techniques to extract the poison from their sacs. But one has to be skilled in catching these snakes, because if one catches the snake in the wrong way, the snake will coil around, will turn around, bite one's arm and inject the poison into one's body. And then one can die. Okay, so here the Buddha uses the simile of the snake. Suppose a man needing a snake, this is a water snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. The snake would turn back on him and bite his hand or its arm or one of his limbs, and because of that he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, and then he just repeats the previous paragraph, some misguided men here learn the Dhamma and so on, and they use it only for criticizing others and winning in debates. And then the teachings, wrongly grasped by them, lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Why is that? Because of the wrong grasp of those teachings. Okay, then there comes the opposite case. This is now the Buddha is going to show how the teaching should be properly used. Here, some clansmen learn the Dhamma, and having learned the Dhamma, they examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Examining the meanings of those teachings with wisdom, they then gain a reflective acceptance of them. That is, the teachings now become clear to their reflection. The teachings agree with their reflection. They come to accept the teachings through reflection. They do not learn the teaching, the Dhamma, for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. And they experience the good, that is, the benefit and the goal, for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Okay, these teachings, being rightly grasped by them, lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Why is that? because of the right grasp of those teachings. Here the key word is sugahita, because the teachings have been well grasped, rightly grasped. It's not that one shouldn't grasp the teachings, but one grasps them correctly in the right way. And this is like a man who needs a snake. He's seeking the water snake, and he sees a large snake. And now this is how he catches it. He uses a cleft stick to pin it down by the neck. And then he grasps the snake rightly by the neck with his hand in such a way that even though the snake wraps its coils around his hand or arm or some other limb, the snake can't turn its head around because the man is holding the snake by its head. And so the man is able to hold, by holding the head of the snake, he's able to master that snake. And the snake cannot bite him. And he's able to, I think they press the head of the snake, and then the poison comes out through the fangs. And they catch it in a bottle and then use it. I used to know an old monk at a place called Island Hermitage in Sri Lanka. He used to go, he used to be able to catch every type of snake with his hand and put it in a bottle. The hermitage was on an island. He would catch, whenever a snake would turn up, he would catch it. They were, must have been water snakes because they had to get onto that island by going across the water. So he would get it with his hand, put it in a bottle, and then send it by boat off to the mainland. Okay, so this is like those monks who grasp the teaching in the right way. Just as the man grasped the snake in the right way, gets the poison, what we call it poison, but it's also a medicine, out from the snake, and then can use that medicine, use that substance to make medicine that can cure many illnesses. So one grasps the teaching in the right way and then gets the beneficial medicine out from the Dhamma and then can use it to cure the illnesses of suffering. So then the Buddha says, therefore, monks, when you understand the meaning of my statements, then remember that meaning accordingly. And when you don't understand the meaning of my statements, then ask me about it, or ask the wise or the knowledgeable monks about it. But if you're uncertain about the meaning, the Buddha is implying, don't just grasp the meaning according to your distorted understanding and then go about propagating your views thinking, I have the right understanding. And though Arita's case is rather extreme, but this way of grasping upon statements from the suttas and then fabricating views based on those sayings. This goes on all through the history of Buddhism. Like even in modern times, I remember a few years ago in Sri Lanka, there was a monk who had the view, even writing articles in magazines and newspapers, saying that we read in the suttas, people would go to listen to sermons from the Buddha. Buddha would speak a sermon. Just when they're sitting there listening, they gain the Dhammacakku, the eye of Dhamma. They become stream enterers. They're people who never practiced meditation before. They just come to hear the sermon. While listening, suddenly something clicks with them. They become stream enterers. So, this monk says, to become stream enterer now, not necessary to practice meditation. Go to sermons. Go to many, many sermons, as many as you can. If you do that, maybe something will click, and then you'll become stream enterer. Some of you have been coming to my sermons for 2 years, 3 years. Anything clicked? Okay, maybe I'll stop here. Okay, if there are any questions, please feel welcome to ask. Peter? I pointed to Peter.
I'm sorry. This phrase, reflective acceptance, I'm trying to understand it a little better. First off, is it the same phrase that's used in, there's a list, like a transcendent dependent origination, where suffering leads to faith leads to going to see teachers, leads to learning here.
It's not transcendentally dependent origination, it comes in 95. I think it's the same. Yeah, let's just see. That's in number 95. It's exactly the same, yeah.
So we understand the same. So this isn't anything insight-based. It's more logical-based or it sounds reasonable.
It would be what I would understand by it as an acceptance of the teaching based upon a deep pondering consideration of the teaching, say reflection upon the teaching, sort of rational understanding of the teaching. It's not yet, the way I would understand it, not yet based upon direct insight into the teaching. Okay, David?
Yes, Father, I was going to ask, since the Buddha proposed the middle way, which basically means everything that is not immoral and natural in moderation, I would assume. Why would it be that something that the human beings are naturally equipped for, such as sexual relations, be totally or someone who is trying to reach enlightenment be totally eradicated. I can't comprehend that. I'm not saying I disagree.
Okay. Let me just repeat the question for the recorders. Okay, since the Buddha taught the middle way, which teaches moderation, why would he teach the elimination of a normal and natural human desire, such as sexuality? Okay, I think first you have to take what is the ultimate goal of Buddhism, which is liberation from samsara, from the round of repeated birth, the round of birth and death. And so to reach the ultimate goal, one has to understand what are the causes and conditions that keep us in bondage to the cycle of repeated existence. And so the Buddha investigated that problem and found that one of the contributing causes, or let's say the main contributing cause, is craving together with ignorance. And craving has different expressions. One of the expressions of craving is sensual craving, and one of the most powerful expressions or manifestations of sensual craving is sexual desire. And so the Buddha teaches that those who wish to reach the ultimate goal of liberation as quickly as possible have to observe a discipline which involves the restraint of the expression of sexual desire. That is to undertake the training, the monastic training, which involves observing the rule of celibacy. And even though it seems that sexual desire is such a strong and natural human trait, but one finds that through the methods taught by the Buddha, that it is possible gradually to sublimate and transform that desire. And by transforming that desire, sublimating it, that force of sexual desire becomes transformed into, I would call it, the empowering force of spiritual development, particularly in meditation. That force of the energy that goes into, that gets expended in sexual enjoyment, when it's contained through restraint, then becomes available to the inner development of the mind through meditation. But now the Buddha, as quite a reasonable teacher, did not expect all of his followers, in fact didn't expect the great majority of his followers, to be interested in, capable of, willing to observe a monastic life. And so the Buddha made known the ultimate goal, made known the training and discipline that leads to the ultimate goal, but also he taught that when we take the long-term perspective, we call it the samsaric perspective, one could see that progress towards that ultimate goal is gradual. And so those who don't feel that calling, that vocation to undertake the training, the discipline in this life, leading as quickly as possible to realization, can approach it in a more gradual, more moderate way by undertaking the way of life, the discipline of a Buddhist lay follower, which doesn't require the training rule of celibacy, but the training rule to abstain from sexual misconduct. And in that way, one can contain the sexual desire so that it doesn't spill out into immoral expressions and channel it within moral limits and still be following the other teachings of the Buddha, which lead to gradual progress. And still, from time to time, as a Buddha's follower, one can be undertaking temporary periods of observing 8 precepts, which includes the rule of celibacy, and then sometimes observing that rule of celibacy for longer periods, and perhaps at some point when we'll develop the desire to undertake the training of a monk, as happens in Buddhist countries, where men who are married will sometimes become ordained as monks, sometimes just for 2 weeks, 1 month, take a temporary ordination as a way of sort of conditioning the mind for becoming a monk at some time, full time in some later life.
But you mean the query instead of just very specifically on sexual design? Can we do that?
Can we say that? Yeah. That the obstacle to liberation is craving.
Not only sexual desire.
Yeah, I said that. Yeah. I said that the main obstacle to liberation, or the main force that keeps one in bondage to the round of birth and death, is craving. And that one of the forms of craving is sensual craving, craving for sense pleasures, and sexual desire is a powerful manifestation of sensual craving.
My question is that that's not among these cravings, that's not talking about sexual desire. There's someone, nowadays there are someone, they are claiming that they love to collect shoes, love to collect books, they love to play piano, they love to play cello. But they don't have any attachment to it. Is it possible?
That they don't have any attachment to it?
Yeah, they just enjoy it, but it's not the obstruction. And nowadays, so many people claim that way. Is it possible according to this? I know that for sexual desire, that's impossible.
Yeah.
How about the other qualities? Someone like the cello. They say, no, I'm still fine. It's good to go to play cello before go to meditation. It helps a lot.
It might well be the case that playing the cello helps a person's mind sort of quiet down and become harmonious, balanced, and then it's easy for the person after playing the cello to get into a meditative state. But I would still think that they have some kind of attachment to playing the cello. I don't see that one could enjoy playing the cello without having some attachment to it.
So according to the pair of minds, they claim it's not really.
I would tend to doubt it. Okay.
I wonder about food.
I mean, just because they enjoy playing the cello doesn't mean they have an attachment. Just because you enjoy eating doesn't mean you have an attachment to it. Is that the proverbial fine line?
It would seem to me difficult to enjoy playing the cello without having an attachment to it.
Then we have to give up everything in life.
No.
Eventually, can't play the cello, can't drive a car, buy clothes.
No, one does eat, but without attachment to it. Because eating is necessary to sustain life.
It is a sensual pleasure,
which is why it's one of the most difficult sensual pleasures to give up, which is why as monks, one does a reflection before taking food. Exactly so. We had gone over this when we did the Sabhasava Sutta. That's one of the reflections for containing the asavas. When eating food, one reflects, one makes use of this food, not for the purpose of enjoyment, for intoxication, for making the body strong and beautiful, but just for the purpose of for sustaining the body, for keeping it alive, for keeping oneself in good health. And so naturally, because the enjoyment of taste is something, a very deeply rooted craving, very, very difficult to overcome. It's one of the most, again, it's one of the deepest expressions of sensual desire. But through the practice of mindfulness, sense restraint, right reflection, one can overcome that craving for sensual desire through the tongue as well. But it's a type of craving that, again, requires a lot of discipline and training to overcome. Yeah, also, this is another thing I would say. Okay, one could be a householder, enjoy playing the cello, enjoy cooking, enjoy good food, and still become a stream enterer, still become a once returner. Because in order to become a stream enterer, once returner, one doesn't have to go beyond the craving for sensual enjoyment. It's if one wants to go from being a once-returner to being a non-returner, can one do that while still being a cello player? Can one do that while still enjoy going to different restaurants? Going to Italian restaurant today, let's go out to go to a Persian restaurant. Have you ever eaten Persian food before? No. Oh, it's wonderful. Somebody wants to go from being a once-returner to non-returner. They'll say, you go to the Persian restaurant. I have other things to do. No interest at all. And somebody who becomes a non-returner, I'm sorry, they will not be a cello player, not be going to different restaurants anymore.
Why don't you just say that somebody should really just, like, I like to get milkshakes, but I usually lose the battle with that one, but I try to restrain myself with eating as best as I can, as best as my conscience will allow me.
Okay, anyway, we have to stop now. It's beyond the hour.